The judicial power of the United States shall be vested in one Supreme Court.
Unless there is any more question, we have to find an argument in this case.
All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of the United States, are admonished to give their attention.
Welcome to Divided Argument, an unscheduled, unpredictable Supreme Court podcast. I'm Dan Epps.
And I'm Will Bode. So Dan, it hasn't been quite as long as it has since our last episode, but I can't say we're going at a really fast clip here.
No.
What's your excuse?
I don't think, and I'm not sure we're going to anytime soon. What's my excuse? I got so many excuses. I'm teaching and still have this baby. Baby's still a baby. Still doing baby stuff. And then Danielle and I have another important collaboration, second big collaboration, 2022, other than the baby, which is we wrote an article that we were just finishing desperately. And it combines some of our favorite things. On her side, it combines interest in common law, private law, property doctrine. On my side, it's two of my favorite things, the Fourth Amendment and saying that you, Will, are wrong.
Really?
Yeah, I'm not sure which of those I like more.
What am I wrong about now?
Well, I mean, many things, but in this particular instance, so for listeners who are not deep into a theory of the Fourth Amendment, Will and friend of the show, James Stern, who clerked for the same judges and judge and justice I did after, right after me, good friend, you wrote this article, gosh, what is it, 4 years ago now?
Six, I think.
Okay, wait, going back, the positive law model of the Fourth Amendment, where, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, but your claim is the kind of test for whether government conduct implicates the Fourth Amendment should be dictated by whether the police have done something that would not be permitted by a private person under the positive law of the relevant jurisdiction where the government conduct occurs.
Exactly. Like breaking into your house is the easy case that everybody, you know, knows is a search or a seizure. And then we try to generalize that to breaking all other laws.
Not just, you know, laws like administrative, like everything, right? Any source of law, like things about trash, rules about trash pickup, right? Like about whether, you know, other people can go pick up trash or whether only the municipal trash collector is allowed to have a monopoly.
So we have some footnotes. We have to deal with some like the obvious weird extensions, like if the police officer speeds in order to get a good look at the driver before pulling him over or in order to pull him over, like does that count? But yes.
I forget what the answer is.
I think we stuck a proximate cause test in there. So it's it depends a little bit on the nature of the speeding and its connection to the arrest, I think is what we said.
Okay.
I have to go back and reread it.
Yeah. I don't know where you pulled that one out of the language of the Fourth Amendment. So this is the idea is you guys almost nailed it. It's a really clever idea. It's a great article. One of my favorite articles in
recent years. Oh, this is good. You could stop there. I think you just submit that.
I'm never going to stop there about anything. There's lots of things you do, Will, that I like, but I'm going to always give you the but. But I think as a theory, I think there are parts of it that are hard to justify. Like your theory is whether something is a search, like literally whether something counts as a search under the Fourth Amendment turns on this question of positive law. And our theory, and you'll see why this combines our two interests. And Danielle, she has no particular interest in saying that you're wrong. She's totally fine with you.
Just to be clear, like Danielle.
That's me. Yeah, she's fine with me wanting to say that you're wrong. So she's obviously on board with it. But our claim is, look, you're trying to make sense of the Fourth Amendment. Fourth Amendment says, you know, bans unreasonable searches and seizures. What does unreasonable mean? Let's actually focus on that word. And well, there's a lot of reason to think that founding generation would have thought reason is kind of tied up with the common law. And there's also reason to think that at the time they would have thought the common law is not, it's not just kind of the positive law of any jurisdiction. The common law is like what we call, what some legal scholars have called like the general law, something that you can kind of, it's law that's not under the control of any one sovereign. It's kind of this set of principles. You look at different jurisdictions and there's sort of some core there. And our claim is that is actually what courts should be doing. And that you, Will, are coming at this with a post-Erie, right? Erie understanding, which is the 20th century case that says, look, there is no common law, the common law. There's just like laws of particular jurisdictions. And so, you know, in addition to having lots of benefits and actually being more consistent with, I think, what the court has done when they've kind of looked to the law, you know, there's cases where Justice Scalia says, look, let's not look to reasonable expectations of privacy. let's look to trespass and things like that. But he's not looking to trespass of Florida trespass law. He's not looking at specific positive law. He's sort of looking at these more general concepts. But so more consistent, has some pragmatic benefits. But maybe I'm not an originalist, but maybe actually I can come and cutting back on your originalist bona fides. Mr. Originalist here, maybe you're not an originalist when it comes to Fourth Amendment theory.
Yeah. Are you trying to out originalist me? Like you're saying maybe. That I'm too 20th century. I'm not sufficiently 19th, 18th century. And you're saying I'm not textualist enough. So it's Will is wrong because he's not sticking close enough.
Yeah. This is what makes it so delightful is that I'm knifing you in the back where you least expect it. You're expecting me to come in, oh, like the living constitution, let's be mushy and cats and I'm reasonable expectations of privacy. And I'm coming around. It's not just because I want to say you're wrong. I actually think it makes a ton of sense.
I mean, look, this is obviously the best way to be knifed in the back by you for not being originalist enough. If that's how I have to go down, you know, I'll live with that.
Yeah, you know, you're not going to go down. This is the nice thing about our profession is it's actually great to be criticized. It's way better to be criticized than to be ignored, right? That's the fear is you just send things out into the void and everyone says, okay, you know, whatever. And so conversation will continue. And I'm sure that you will perhaps on this podcast tell me why I have gotten it wrong. But anyways, article, Fourth Amendment and General Law, we will be making it available online at some point, sending it out to journals. And so that was fun. And now I have a little bit more time.
If it, I think it hasn't been picked up by a journal yet. It's looking for a home.
It is looking for a home.
Well, maybe I'll have to write one of those online responses, whoever picks it up.
Okay, that's a deal. It's an enforceable contract. You also have a piece that you just placed. It's severability. Is that, am I remembering right? Tell us about that.
Severability first principles. So far as I don't know, do you have views about severability, Dan? Can I say you're wrong too? Or do I just have to?
I probably have some instincts that, so once you describe it, I will tell you whether they line up with my instincts, but I have not written those down and don't particularly expect to because it seems like an interesting enough topic, but not one that's at the top of my research agenda. Although maybe you will say something that I think is so wrong that I can write a response. I'll say, look, I've never written anything about severability. I don't teach Fed courts, but Bode is so wrong. I'm going to have to enter the fray. So lay it on me.
All right. Well, so everybody is wrong other than Justice Thomas and maybe John Harrison and Kevin Walsh. Okay.
So this is kind of predictable from you.
Even Justice Gorsuch might be wrong.
Okay.
That pains me to write. That's the hardest part of the article to write. So the basic problem of severability is...
Where is he on your hierarchy of favorite justices, if you're willing to say?
Where is Justice Gorsuch?
Yeah. Number two, number one, number three.
Tied for number one.
How many are tied for number one? Three or four? Four.
Six? Five?
Six? No. Okay. Yeah. Five, maybe. Because you can't really bump the chief. I was going to think that the four self-described originalists would be tied for one.
I think there are more than four self-described originalists.
Alito, so has the chief said he's an originalist?
No.
Has the Alito said he's an originalist?
Yes.
McDonald? I mean, because he also makes fun of originalism.
He just made fun of the original intent style of originalism, where we'd have to ask what James Madison would have said about video games, which has been wildly overplayed.
He also, I was thinking Fourth Amendment, he also makes fun of this the tiny constable, for the GPS, the case about GPS tracking. He says it's ridiculous to look back to 18th century tort law. We should kind of do the mushy, reasonable expectations of privacy inquiry.
Justice Alito said in several interviews that he's an originalist. I think there's some questions about, you know, where he is with precedent, and there are some labels people have applied, like Burkean originalist or things like that. But he said he's an originalist.
Do you think that's accurate? I know we're just kind of, this is just getting very discursive, but it's a fun conversation. So, I mean, I think that seems like maybe a less apt label for him compared to some of the others, certainly than Thomas, Gorsuch, and maybe Barrett.
I mean, I think a conventional view that puts Thomas and Gorsuch as the most originalist, Barrett and Kavanaugh as slightly less originalist, although definitely self-described originalist, and then people like Alito and Kagan and the chief kind of trailing them, and then Sotomayor on like another plane.
Yeah, I mean, because like, yeah, Kagan has endorsed textualism, right?
And originalism.
Yeah.
She specifically
endorsed originalism.
At her confirmation hearing, she specifically endorsed the view that in deciding what level of generality we should interpret the text at, we should ask what level of generality the framers wrote it at, what they intended it to be.
Intent. She's an original intent person?
She didn't say intent exactly. She said what they commanded. She's an original meaning person, probably.
Yeah, this is an interesting thing for the again, just going on tangents for listeners who are maybe not deep into originalism, which is when you say originalism, there's different things you could mean by that. You could mean the sort of early version was, let's look at what the founders thought. Like, let's find out, read their secret diary and figure out what they thought. And I think almost everybody doesn't, on the original side, even thinks that's wrong now. Is that fair?
Almost everybody, yeah.
Yeah, almost everybody. And then there's kind of original meaning. What did this mean? You know, to people ratifying it at the time seems more defensible. You have this original law, like you look at how this would have been understood to change the law, right?
Yeah. And what like legal doctrines would have been used to interpret it at the time.
Yeah.
So I think it's actually a mistake to put all the justices we just named on sort of like one hierarchy, because I think there are just some like cross-cutting issues. Like Justice Thomas and Justice Gorsuch are less in precedent than anybody else. So they bring their originalism out and use it to overrule cases more often than others. But, you know,
Justice Barrett, we're not totally sure where she is on that, right?
Not as much. I mean, she wrote something about professor. She just descriptively has not yet sort of.
I mean, her scholarship I took before she got on the bench to mean that she was not going to be a big believer in stare decisis.
Yeah, her scholarship's pretty nuanced. It has a lot of one interesting theme in the scholarship that she's picked up on the bench is, of course, that since the court picks its own docket, a lot of the time stare decisis does its work just because the court is never going to grant cert on whether to overturn the legal tender cases or whatever. Yeah. And that's, you know, she's done that in some of the shadow docket cases. Yeah. So let's just stay out of this. And then Justice Alito, I think part of what marks him is just he is very committed to not being a chump. So he just has which is actually just another theory of precedent in a way, is like he's very committed to the view that if like this doctrine doesn't apply for the goose, that it also doesn't apply for the gander and vice versa. And that mm-hmm. that's popped up in a lot of his sort of famously strange concurrences.
That comes up in Janus, right?
It comes up in Janus.
Union dues case.
Yeah. Where Eugene Volokh and I actually tried to enter as the, you know, pro union originalist.
Yeah, I liked that. I like you guys had a
Justice Alito did not like it.
No, it didn't go anywhere.
But one of his points was that the unions in the case were themselves against originalism in other cases. And so, you know, it's not
really
like,
makes sense as a.
It makes sense in a way. It's just a different question about judging. It's sort of like a game theory question or a question of unilateral disarmament, which I feel like we encounter a lot of the time. You know, back in our discussions about court reform, we have people who might say, in a first best world, I'd be deferential to Congress. But if they're not going to be deferential, then I'm not going to be deferential. It's the same kind of thing.
It seems like I would think you would believe that the judge should follow what their view of the law is, right? I will come up with, because you're a liberal living constitutionalist, I will now be a conservative living constitutionalist or a common good theorist.
I don't think you should be a common good theorist. And Justice Alito also in his unrecorded speech at Notre Dame declined to embrace common good constitutionalism, according to my sources.
Which is a topic of a new book by Adrian Vermeule, which I just got in my inbox and I'm looking forward to reading. Maybe we will discuss that on a future episode. I imagine you have some views about that. But can we talk about your severability thing?
Sure. Okay. So the question of severability is just when a law has some part that's unconstitutional, what do you do with the rest of it? And the conventional doctrine is that you ask, more or less you ask, what would Congress have wanted us to do if they had known that they had a part of their law be unconstitutional? Would they have wanted to keep all of it? Would they have wanted to get rid of all of it? Would they wanted to do something slightly more complicated? But this doctrine does not, you know, nobody's very happy with how this doctrine applies just as a practical level. And then it's also, as a theoretical matter, you know, it's asking a question that we pretty much have stopped asking in federal interpretation. Like even the judges who are not Justice Gorsuch agree that you're no longer supposed to ask questions like, what would Congress have wanted if it had thought about a thing that we know they didn't think about? That's just both like conceptually not a very coherent inquiry and practically not something judges are good at. They just end up finding themselves there.
And also like the way the question was framed seems to kind of presuppose a view about what courts are doing in constitutional adjudication when they're exercising judicial review that is maybe not, my guess is not what you think that they should be doing, which is like judges aren't like, they're not going with like a red pen and sort of striking out parts of laws, right? Right. They're not just kind of like taking stuff out of the U.S. code. What they're doing is they're saying in this case, this law purports to do this. That's not constitutional. And so we will not enforce that, or we will say that, you know, you have a remedy that this law can't be enforced against you or something like that, right? They're not like excising.
That's exactly chapters. Right. That's exactly right. So my article is basically, if you start from the two formalist premises that law is based on what, you know, Congress enacts, not just like their hopes and dreams, and that what judges do is just try to apply the law in the cases before them, not wield what one scholar has called a writ of erasure to, you know, erase statutes in the books.
Which scholar?
Jonathan Mitchell. You ever heard of him?
Yeah, we've talked about this article before. This is the theoretical underpinnings of the Texas abortion law. So it sounded like this high academic theory actually has some very important consequences, real world consequences. I think I agree with the second formalist principle, maybe less than the first one.
Okay.
Is that I want to think about that, but there might be situations where, you know, we might say, like, what is the way to understand this law, how it should operate, like, under these circumstances? I don't know. Maybe that's – it doesn't necessarily have to be an intent question.
Yeah, and that's actually part of the – one of the surprising reveals of the article, I'll just say now, is that even formalists who think they reject congressional intent often find themselves unable to resist using it in a subset of cases. For instance, you know, about a third of the article is about – what happens when the constitutional problem is really an unconstitutional combination, two different statutory provisions, either one of which alone would be okay, but together they're not okay? Because then the kind of the standard formalist instincts in a lot of these cases of just, you know, just ignore the unconstitutional one doesn't work, because it's like, which one do you ignore? And congressional intent, various more objectified forms of intent, could be one way you decide, you know, look, if we can't have both of these, which one is supposed to be enforceable, which one's supposed to be unenforceable?
So I have it in my head. What's a case where that happens? You have the conflict.
Easy one is PCAOB versus the Free Enterprise Fund, the peekaboo, where this.
So the board, four cause, two layers of four cause removal.
Right. You can't have two layers of four cause removal. So which layer do you have?
Yeah, that's interesting.
Lots and lots of cases have this form. So a bunch of the Supreme Court's recent cases, like the removal cases about the CFPB and then the second one about Fannie and Freddie, are like this, because on the one hand, the person is given a bunch of broad executive enforcement powers, and on the other hand, they're given for cause removal protections, and everybody agrees you could have one of those, but not the other. And so which one do you get rid of?
And so do you have a way to figure that out?
I have three. I mean, part of the...
Which is three different ones that I have to choose between? Four. Or
yeah. The point is that...
You got to give us the answer.
Well, the point is that you should figure it out through statutory interpretation. And this is obviously an area where you have to interpret the statute on a question where it doesn't actually say what to do. And so depending on exactly how textualist you are, like how, just exactly what you said, how far you reject the kind of like no intent premise, there are different ways to solve it. If you're a kind of soft textualist, so you think like generally we should focus on text, but intent could be useful on questions where the text is really very silent, then you might well use intent to ask which one you should keep. For the justices who aren't, which includes some of the justices on the court who are grappling with this problem, they instead have to make use of like the canons and the substantive canons, which is what they do. That has all the standard problems with substantive canons. So the back half ends up being a kind of acid test for formalism. Like, how does formalism handle hard questions?
So basically, it sounds like you're not totally able to solve some of the hard issues here, right? This is a problem that even thinking about it from the right, what you see as the right premises does not just kind of make these problems go away.
Yeah, it doesn't have one unique solution. I think the right way to put it is if any given justice called me and said, how do I resolve an unconstitutional combinations problem? I could tell them, given their own methodology, how they should resolve the unconstitutional combinations problem. But I don't adjudicate between whether Justice Gorsuch or Justice Kavanaugh is a better justice.
This is consistent with your insistence that you have a six tied for first. Coward. It's not way. I don't believe that's what you really think.
I call it
a fishing. You just want them all to cite you.
Not doing so well on that score. One of the consequences along the way is I talk about the California versus Texas, the Affordable Care Act case that we, you know, talked about. Mm-hmm. And Justice Gorsuch was wrong to think that the Affordable Care Act was inseparable. And although Justice Thomas and Justice
Gorsuch were both right to think. As a matter of statutory interpretation?
Exactly.
Okay.
Once you see that inseparability has to just be a question of statutory interpretation, and look at the Affordable Care Act through the kind of lens of interpretation that Justice Gorsuch and Justice Thomas believe in, there's no evidence of any kind of inseparability.
Okay. Well, I will look forward to reading that. That is forthcoming, right? Virginia Law Review?
The Virginia Law Review.
But is not on SSRN yet, correct?
That's right. It'll go up pretty soon. I'm just kind of, I presented it at a conference in San Diego about a week and a half ago, and I'm trying to input all the.
Oh, this is the originalism, the kind of the home of originalism, right? The San Diego conference.
Indeed.
That in David Posen's parody of Larry Solom's originalism articles. He did an April Fool's parody. Larry Solom used to do these really, really funny April Fool's parodies of other academics. And Dave Posen said, the sanction for not being original and stuff is exile from San Diego, right?
Yeah. And it's, I mean, on the one hand, I will say it's a, you don't have to be an originalist to go. Eric Siegel, a trenchant critic of originalism, was there all weekend and letting us have it, and blogged afterwards about what an amazing experience it was and, you know, how grateful he is for the kind of free exchange we have. But it is still true that if it didn't happen at San Diego, did it really happen in originalism?
Well, we all have our own ideas of what counts as a good time. Listeners, you make your own judgment as to whether that one, that weekend in San Diego, sounds like what you'd want to spend your free time doing, but more power to you, Will. Okay, well, we'll look for that one. I will look forward to sharing my piece once ready to. Friend of the show, Oren Kerr, I'm sure is going to have views, but I'm waiting to send it to you until we do one more round of revisions on that. So, anything else? We're just kind of trying to fill things up because we don't have that much. Unlike the last time, there's some things that have happened, but not necessarily as many things that we have like lots of things to say about.
That's right. That's right.
Okay. Big thing that happened.
Oh. Yeah. Justice Breyer wrote an opinion.
Ah, yeah. That's the one everyone was waiting for.
Is that the one you're thinking
of? What was this about? Definitely. What was this about?
So Justice Breyer, the Supreme Court issued one opinion last week, a case called Unicolors, Inc. versus H&M, which is an intellectual property case, sort of. It's a case about basically the definition of intent in the copyright statute. It's an opinion by Justice Breyer. So as soon as I read it, I thought, aha, this is a swan song. He's finally going to show Dan that, you know, he's really knows how to write over the ages. The question is, when you obtain a registration for your copyright and you put some claims, some information in your registration that is inaccurate, when does that impair the validity of your registration? And in particular, if you make a mistake of law, that is, if you say something about previously valid copyrights that you're wrong about because, you know, it's not of some factual mistake. It's not that you didn't know that something was out there, but of some legal mistake. You didn't know whether they were valid or whether there was some sort of defense. Does it count? The question is, when does that invalidate your registration?
And so walk me through why it should invalidate your registration, because the Copyright Office relies on it in some way. And
yeah, and you need to have an incentive to get your story straight. So I just have to, let me just give you, because this is Justice Breyer, part two, the substantive part of his opinion has the perfect Breyer-esque introduction. A brief analogy may help explain the issue we must decide. Suppose that John, seeing a flash of red in a tree, says, "There is a cardinal." But he is wrong. The bird is not a cardinal. It is a scarlet tanager. John's statement is inaccurate. But what kind of mistake has John made? John may have failed to see the bird's black wings. In that case, he's made a mistake about the brute facts. Or John may have seen the bird perfectly well, noting all of its relevant features. But not being much of a bird watcher, he may not have known that a tanager, unlike a cardinal, has black wings. In that case, he's made a labeling mistake. He saw the bird correctly, but does not know how to label what he saw. Here, Unicolor's mistake is a mistake of labeling. And they go on. So that's the question is, that's the case.
I'm struggling to see how that analogy helps.
That analogy just sets up the problem.
Okay.
Right. And the problem is basically, do we expect people who register for copyrights to be ornithologists?
Where ornithologist is defined as like being a lawyer, making legal conclusions. Okay.
So mostly I liked it for the analogy. The answer, by the way, is no, you don't have to be an ornithologist. So if you make a mistake of law, okay.
And the analogy is like you get kicked out of the birdwatching club for the first mistake, but not the second, right? I'm having trouble seeing how it tracks, but maybe it doesn't. I always like to dig deep on analogies to see like how far they go. And this one sounds like maybe it doesn't take us, it just gets us through the door, but doesn't take us further.
Yeah, don't do that. Here's the other reason I wanted to mention it, other than because I know you love Justice Breyer's opinions, is there's a dissent by Justice Thomas, Justice Alito, and Justice Gorsuch as to all but part two. The dissent, at least the part that Justice Gorsuch joins, the bulk of the dissent, doesn't actually disagree with the majority. Their main argument is not the majority is wrong about the definition of knowledge, whether knowledge requires what it requires. Their complaint is that the court was the victim of a bait and switch. That the original petition for cert asked the court to grant cert on the question, on a question in which there was a circuit split, whether or not the copyright statute's knowledge element requires quote unquote indicia of fraud. And yet, after having persuaded us to grant certiorari on this issue, Unicolors has chosen to rely on a different argument in its merits briefing. It no longer argues that the statute requires fraudulent intent, and instead proposes a novel actual knowledge standard. Because I would not reward Unicolors for its ledger domain, and because no other court had before today ever addressed whether the statute requires actual knowledge, I would dismiss the writ of certiorari as improperly granted.
Okay, this is interesting in a couple of ways. I mean, so one is, you know, trying to figure out exactly what the difference is between those two things. So basically one is option is, you know, did you actually intend to deceive versus did you know that what you were saying is inaccurate?
Mm-hmm.
There is a difference. I like this case because it seems to be like playing with some criminal law concepts. Yes. And then in part two of Justice Thomas's opinion, he's actually citing a case that I taught last week in criminal law about mistake of law, Cheek versus United States, which is in the context of criminal tax enforcement, where we say there's a duty. Sorry, when we say that you can't be punished for criminal tax evasion unless you knew that you were violating the tax laws. Very unusual. It's not how these things usually work, but they're doing something similar, I guess, on the copyright side. But it raises this other question of like when, how much flexibility do you have as a litigant in the Supreme Court to kind of shift your position? Because you can obviously make arguments that you didn't make in the petition. You know, whenever you write a merits brief, like people come up with, they spend, you know, a couple months working on these, they come up with really clever arguments that maybe weren't apparent when they wrote the shorter cert petition. But when does that switch slide into actually just arguing for a position that you didn't get the court to grant cert on?
Yeah, exactly. And especially because, I mean, exactly right. On the one hand, we want litigants to be able to bring their best arguments to the court, because once the court decides the case, it's going to make nationwide precedent. And we're never going to look back and say, well, that case wasn't very, you know, very well, so it doesn't really hold that or something. You know, we need to get it right. But there is this obvious sort of chance of gamesmanship, right? Is that to get the court to grant cert, to get the, you know, the cert pool clerk to pull it out of the stack, you need to show them this is something that a lot of circuit courts have disagreed about. So you need to show a split, but that may not be the best argument to win, right? So I assume what happened is they had a sort of acknowledged circuit split, was their, you know, ticket into the court. But then once they started thinking about what arguments are actually going to convince the court to interpret the statute our way, they had this different argument.
Yeah, that doesn't strike me as necessarily bad, because if it turns out that sometimes it turns out that the circuit courts have kind of seen an issue along one axis, and then the best way to interpret it is maybe something in the middle or something that kind of looks at some slightly different factor. But the one thing Justice Thomas notes, which maybe is worth caring about, is that this is not something that other courts, you know, lower courts have had a chance to really opine on.
Right.
Right. He says that the court does this without permitting any other court in the country to first consider the question. So basically, the court is, you know, court likes to kind of let legal issues percolate, see what lower court judges say, see how the arguments develop, so they can really be sure they're resolving a question with all the appropriate information.
Right. Because you could imagine, I mean, this does sometimes happen, right? Is the clever person arguing the case is like, hey, I have a crazy new theory about how to interpret the statute that nobody's ever come up with before. I bet I can sell this to them. And like on its face, it's pretty plausible. But then once you learn as a justice that nobody's ever considered this before, and you only have, you know, a few months to think about it and all its implications, you're like, well, I'd kind of like it if this had been put to the, you know, somebody kicked the tires on this for a little while, just so we could flesh out like the problems I'm not thinking about.
You know, the CATS test, the reasonable expectations of privacy test, which comes from actually from a concurring opinion by Justice Harlan and Katz, that wasn't even presented in the briefs. That was just something the advocate just kind of threw out there at oral argument. And that has defined, been the test for key test for Fourth Amendment law for the last 55 years. So is that bad? Yeah. Is that good? I don't know.
Well, I mean, my sense is this used to be more common than it is. And this is part of the other thing. It's like, of course, sometimes the reason the court accepts these pivots is because they don't know the answer, or they don't like the answering the question presented very much. But this other way of answering it, you know, allows them to build a consensus or, you know, get a majority, or it makes more sense to them.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not totally, you know, I think you're deeper into this one than I am. So I want to see what you think. But I guess just thinking about it in the abstract, it seems like this isn't clearly something that's totally out of left field. I mean, aren't you you're kind of arguing about what the kind of, this is not criminal law, but what we call like the mens rea is, like what the mental state requirement is here. And, you know, sometimes maybe it's fraudulent intent, or maybe it isn't, but maybe there's something in the middle, right? Is this that different? Or is this somehow orthogonal to those questions?
I guess I think anything on the spectrum of how much you're kind of swapping in the QP, this is not the most egregious version the court has seen. And in some of the more egregious versions that Justice Thomas mentions, the court has dismissed the cases and providently granted. But it does seem, I mean, as I understand it, it does seem a little bit like a pivot or a swap from sort of what you might have thought was there to what you have now. And I think that in the past, the court had shown at least a little bit of interest in actually trying to deter that kind of conduct by, you know, dismissing the cases and providently granted. I mean, another thing that happens in several of these cases, I think it happened here, is that the lawyer who petitioned for cert is not the same as the lawyer who took over the case for the merits brief. And that's obviously part of the reason you have a new Supreme Court expert take over the merits briefing, is they might be able to frame the case in a different way that's, you know, more helpful.
But, yeah. Yeah. And it puts lawyers in a tough position, which is like, you might think, gosh, I don't want to argue this original position because I just really looked at the law. There's just no way we can win on that, right? Maybe it's a weak argument. But you also know that if you make the argument that's more persuasive, you're now increasing the risk that you just kind of, the case petition gets dismissed. Here, unclear whether this was a conscious gamble or just, you know, they thought it was going to be fine. But here that seems to pay off.
Yeah.
Right.
And I think the truth is that's probably what you want if you're the court, is you don't want a rule, you want a standard. Because sometimes the court will do a better job with the case if it reframes it. But you don't want this happening all the time, because then you lose control of your own docket and you're constantly answering these novel questions. So you want to refuse these invitations often enough that people know it's a gamble. They don't just think like, oh, you know, we have total freedom to make this case about anything we want to.
Yeah. But there does seem like a difference between like making an argument that the lower court is wrong on its statutory interpretation versus like introducing a totally new legal issue. It's like if they were like, you know, yes, courts didn't address this, but this is actually a due process violation. I mean, that seems more troubling than kind of the court saying, well, here's a different way to read the statute. Or an advocate saying, here's a different way to read the statute.
Yeah. Although even, I mean, so think of the abortion case, Dobbs, right? The court granted, not on a question that was explicitly, should Roe versus Wade be overruled? And then when it got to the court, it turned into, should Roe versus Wade be overruled? They were on the same topic. It was like abortion constitutionality arguments. But
yeah. But you might think in that situation, look, the court could say, look, there's no way, you know, for us to decide this legal issue without, you know, resolving this antecedent issue or something like that. And there, you know, certainly the court has more flexibility to address issues that are not presented by the advocates than the advocates do, right? The court can kind of, as long as it's supported by the record, they can.
Right. But then if the court's going to do it, we kind of want the advocates to be able to talk to them about it. I mean,
yeah.
And similarly, you could imagine saying, getting a statute interpretation question and saying, well, it's just hard to think about this statute without acknowledging that the whole thing is unconstitutional, or vice versa, a constitutional question where you say, well, it's harder to really understand this constitutional challenge because people are kind of confused what the statute does. So you can see how you end up toggling across those kinds of things.
Yeah. And if the court comes out with something that like nobody realized that they were thinking about, that increases some risk of error, right? Because the parties could maybe point to, look, if you interpret the statute this way, that all has all these bad consequences you're not thinking of. So I don't know. I'm not sure there's an easy answer here, but the court seems to conclude that this was okay. Majority does. And why do you think Justice Gorsuch doesn't join part two of Justice Thomas's opinion, where he sort of says a couple things? He says, you know, the thing I noted about how no other court in the country has addressed this specific argument, but also sort of says this test that they're using is kind of really kind of out of left field. This actual knowledge requirement is something that's out of left field and something that is not really sort of throwing cold water in the actual substantive legal issue.
Right. I mean, so it could just be he doesn't have a view. My guess is he's sympathetic to the majority on the merits, you know, and that Justice Gorsuch often does have a kind of different approach in a lot of criminal cases than Justice Thomas and Justice Alito might. So he might see it as less anomalous to have a kind of more generous mens rea requirement, but he still cares about the, you know, the bait and switch principle.
Yeah. Why do we think this kind of seems to have an ideological slant? Because I think, is it fair to say Justices Alito, Thomas, Gorsuch are the three most conservative justices? You think that's fair?
People say that. I'm not going to.
Oh, come on, Will. I'm not going to say anything.
I mean, you know, Justice Gorsuch has Bostock and McGirt. Yeah. And it's
okay,
confusing.
But on balance. But this does seem to, and then you have, some people have said, like, there's these three kind of, you know, there's the justices, you know, Chief Justice Roberts and Justices Kavanaugh and Barrett kind of in the middle of the court, kind of the controlling the axis of power, and then the three liberals and then the three more conservatives.
Yeah.
And it does seem to break down on those lines. I couldn't really figure out why.
Me neither. So yeah, I couldn't figure that out. And I couldn't figure out if that's because of sort of like criminal law presumptions, if there's a sort of ideological slant to copyright registration that, I mean, I assume there is because there's everything that I don't totally get, or whether it's, you know, specific skepticism of this kind of layering tactic.
You know, sometimes they didn't tell you at San Diego. They didn't say, like, this is why, this is the secret reason why.
This case was not discussed at San Diego.
Okay. Well, if the Federalist Society sends you a coded message telling you what the right answer was in this case and why, please share it with us.
I'll read it on the air.
No, you won't. You'll deny any knowledge of it. We should talk about that at some time, by the way.
Okay.
Doing a Federalist Society event, by the way, it should be
good for you.
And this week we're talking about originalism, attacking you from the right, doing a Federalist Society event, but as the lib.
Yeah. Who's the con?
Several folks, but I am kind of paired up with my friend, Ethan Davis, former clerk for Justice Gorsuch and my former associate when we were both at King & Spalding. We worked on a Supreme Court case together. A criminal case, Ocasio versus United States. And we are talking about something that is, I think, is going to be our next topic. We are talking about the new Supreme Court nominee and how she might affect the court on criminal justice issues. So me and my former criminal law co-counsel, I'm talking about that. Unfortunately, I don't know yet. I'm going to do some research on that in the next couple of days. So I don't know. Can't give you a preview of my views. I think the short answer is probably not that much, because in general, this nomination is probably not going to change the court all that much because it doesn't change the balance of power.
Maybe.
But Justice Breyer was more kind of pragmatic on some criminal law, criminal procedure issues.
Right. Yeah. So should we talk about the new nominee?
Yes. So we do have new nominee. D.C. Circuit Judge, recent D.C. Circuit Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson, who I think it's safe to say was the front runner for most of the process.
Yes.
Heading all in. Up. Yeah. I mean, there were sort of three that people thought it might be. Judge Michelle Childs, California Supreme Court Justice Leandra Krueger, and Judge Brown Jackson. I think David Latt, who watches these things very carefully, had Judge Brown Jackson as the front runner for some time, and that is what happens. Seems like a very the logical choice for President Biden. He had pledged to nominate the first Black woman in the Supreme Court. She was recently confirmed, got on the D.C. Circuit, and so you've got a lot of confidence that she's not going to have issues at the confirmation hearing. Now, the Supreme Court confirmation hearings, they're going to dig a little deeper than they do at D.C. Circuit, but you at least, you know, that's at least some vetting, more vetting than you have from Justice Krueger, who has not been through a Senate confirmation
Right. Judge and she Childs. Picked up some Republican votes too, right? When she was
confirmed. Which? TV oh, yeah. Day, yes. Judge yeah. Jackson. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. And she's kind of the right age. She has a very impressive resume, former clerk for Justice Breyer. So we have this kind of passing of the gauntlet from justice to former clerk, which we had with Justice Kennedy, which I don't feel a little uncomfortable about. It seems kind of like this, you know, hereditary position at this point, but that's where we are.
I predict this is going to become a thing, that if it's the same, if it's not a party switch, so obviously, you know, Justice Ginsburg was not replaced with the Ginsburg clerk. There are not very many conservative Ginsburg clerks out there. But I predict this is going to become kind of the new default.
Really?
It's the same, yeah. I mean, why? I'm not saying it should be.
Why the default? Why would we, if Justice Kagan retires, why would we limit ourselves to only Justice Kagan clerks versus like Justice Sotomayor clerks or people, maybe there's people who didn't clerk on the Supreme Court who are pretty good lawyers.
Yeah, I'm not saying. So there were news accounts that the Breyer thing really mattered to President Biden, that like he really liked that. I think one thing that happens is the president, you know, president will naturally be praising the departing justice as like a great justice and will likely be saying, I want to appoint a justice in this person's mold. And so then that's just like a natural way to do it. You got to limit the search somehow. It is more and more common for the nominee to be a Supreme Court clerk. Relatively an overwhelming majority of the recent nominations have been Supreme Court clerks.
Yeah, there is very much a sameness to the resumes of the people that get nominated these days. Elite law school, Supreme Court clerk. Now, one difference here, which is Judge Brown Jackson was a public defender, right? That's exactly. That's something different. We're going to talk about on my panel about her views on criminal justice. And that's unusual, right? And that is a place where President Biden has emphasized in his judicial appointments, emphasized professional diversity, which I think is good, right? There's been a lot of former prosecutors who are on the bench, far fewer public defenders.
Yeah, I think that's great. Have you gotten your hands on her senior thesis yet?
No. Tell me about it.
I would like a copy, so if somebody has one. Her senior thesis in college was entitled The Hand of Oppression, Plea Bargaining Processes and the Coercion of Criminal Defendants.
It sounds pretty good.
Relevant.
Sounds yeah. Pretty good. Okay. I'm going to have to acquire that the next year or two.
You know, for readers who don't know, obviously, the plea bargaining process is the, you know, the lifeblood of the criminal justice system, where we get everybody to give up all their constitutional rights and just accept a punishment because we would threaten them with greater punishment if they tried to actually exercise their constitutional rights.
I taught in criminal procedure adjudication today. I taught
Bordenkercher
versus Hayes. Remember this one, Will? This is where
the Supreme Court said this is fine.
Yeah. And then where the prosecutor says, you know, charging a guy for writing a forged check. Right. And he says, look, you plead guilty, you get 5 years. If you go to trial, I'm going to reindict you on a habitual offender statute and give you life in prison. It seems like that should be not OK. Right.
Right.
It's OK. It's fine. Court says it's OK. So she thinks maybe she thinks that's not OK.
And, you know, again, on the positive law model, it's a kind of behavior that if it weren't done by the government, right, if somebody said like, consent to this contract or I will lock you up for 75 years. I think most courts have a pretty easy time finding consent, you know, invalid.
That's how you got me on the show.
Don't tell. If she's going to successfully get you out of this podcast, then I'm not in favor anymore.
No state action, unfortunately. So okay. No federal jurisdiction.
Yeah, good.
Yeah, although maybe you're so enmeshed with the conservative justices that what you do counts as state action.
That's a good one.
No riposte. Okay, I'm going to claim victory on that. So I guess I don't have a lot substantively to say right now because I have not dug into the record and, you know, read opinions and so forth. And I hope to do that in the coming days and have more to say. And we'll see what the hearings are going to look like. But this is not necessarily something that we should expect, like huge fireworks. We're going to have the normal kind of political wrangling, and a GOP Twitter account is trying to position her as a radical leftist, and you know probably in the end we'll see a close to party line vote, but you know, we'll see.
Yeah, I think there'll be I think very little interesting is going to happen. I guess that's the point. We don't really know. Who knows what will come out of the woodwork, but this is just going to be an example of the, you know, the current setup where almost every senator's vote is predictable in advance. So there's almost no incentive for anybody in the process to give and take at all.
And it's also an issue where political bases care a lot, right? And so a lot of what is happening is kind of posturing for political bases, because there are these advocacy organizations, advocacy groups that stir people up. The judicial, this is my favorite one on the right. One of the, changes its name from Judicial Confirmation Network when Republicans are in power to Judicial Crisis Network whenever Democrats are in power, which I love how shameless it is, but they're going to get very riled up and try to get a bunch of donations about, you know, radical leftists. And so that causes a lot of pressure, I think, for senators to vote on party lines.
Yeah, it's a little weird. I mean, I think that you're right descriptively. It's a little weird. Like, what's the incentive for the Republican senators who know she's going to be confirmed and who think, as surely some of them must think, that in the scheme of things, she's pretty good of all the nominees they could have expected and feared? I don't understand why everybody is so, why politics demands that they vote no or, you know, pretend that she's the worst ever. I agree that seems to be what politics demands. Same thing with, you know, like people who tried to filibuster John Roberts. I don't get it, really.
Because the people that engage base wants to see fighters, right? They don't like compromises. I mean, this is sort of what's part of what's wrong with our system right now, right?
Yeah, but like, so why do the interest groups want to see fight? The interest groups who are stirring up the base, why is that what they demand?
Well, I think they just want donations, and you know, they've staked out these positions, and this gets people riled up and causes them to donate. I don't know. I mean, there's different interest groups. I mean, there's not an interest group for like the moderate interest group, and like, let's all get along. Right.
But it's not even moderate. I just mean, like, if you're trying to achieve the most conservative judiciary possible, part of how you would achieve the most conservative judiciary possible would be to make confirmation easy when people on the other side, when Democrats nominated somebody more moderate, and make confirmation hard when nominated somebody more radical in the scheme of the possible. And sometimes, you know, there are some groups that do that. There's some groups that could give us a good scorecard to somebody in the other party for being like better on the issues they care about.
Although it could have been, you know, we don't know the counterfactual of what would have happened if Judge Childs, who I think, you know, ended up being perceived as kind of more conservative, if Judge Childs was the nominee versus Judge Brian Jackson.
So, right. So maybe in this case, maybe that's the opposition will be, we're so upset that it's not Judge Childs. I mean, that's what the Republicans will say. But I predict that there will be very little worth talking about, but we should probably talk about it when the hearings happen.
Yeah, we will. Although I think, you know, our general approach is we don't talk about everything. We kind of talk about things when we've got something to say and maybe something other people haven't said, or some our own idiosyncratic take. And maybe we will have that on these. But, you know, these confirmation hearings sort of follow script. I did sort of worked for Senator Whitehouse on the Barrett confirmation, did some research and stuff. And that was interesting. But again, there was just the whole thing was kind of, there was a script that went by. And so there's not a lot of interesting action, right? I mean, sometimes things go off the rails that happen with the Kavanaugh nomination, but for the most part, we kind of just know how these things work.
I mean, yeah, and sometimes the theater can sometimes be useful. Like in the first part of the Kavanaugh nomination, there was this, in the circles I travel in, there was this interesting drama about whether or not he was going to say he was an originalist.
San Diego. This is the San Diego talk. Metaphorical San Diego, at least.
I was thinking of the coded Federal Society Secret messages.
That too. Well, it's the same thing, I thought. You just have to figure out a way to not let Eric Siegel hear what you're saying in San Diego.
It doesn't work that way, Dan. Anyway,
so you're off your game today, Will. You're not getting me with the rejoinders.
You stabbed me in the back in the first 10 minutes of the episode. You're expecting to recover already?
You can come back from that. You love getting criticized.
I do.
Yeah.
Especially when you know, it just proves that I was right in the first place.
Okay. Well, we'll see. Stay tuned on that. We'll try to add some value if we can. And if not, we will just take a long time before recording again. Okay. One other thing to follow up on, and that you may have violated your promise to yourself to never say anything critical of the justices, right? Which is, you said, I think you said,
criticize them all the time, Dan.
Well, you don't like to make it, you don't like to get too personal. You like to be nice.
I don't know any of them.
You know them enough. I think you said, like, Justice Barrett was like the best law professor to be appointed to the court, like, since Felix Frankfurter or something, right?
Oh, since Justice Story, I think I said, but
that was going back to 1830 or whatever. And we got some feedback on that. You know, I sort of pushed back and said, what about Breyer? Breyer wrote some famous stuff. And then, you know, what about Kagan? Justice Kagan, right? You forgot about her. And I did some research on that. Yeah. She had more citations as a legal scholar at the time of her appointment than Justice Barrett did, suggesting kind of maybe greater influence as a law professor. You buy that?
I'm not sure. Maybe. It's a good point. And I should say, you know, Justice Kagan started her scholarly career at the University of Chicago, where I now teach. There's a plaque on the wall outside her office, you know, memorializing the greatness, the great thoughts that were once within. So,
although famously, they did not give her tenure when she was left for long enough to be in the government during the Clinton administration. She had gotten tenure at Chicago. She left and had to give up her tenure because she was gone for long enough. And then they didn't have her come back with tenure.
Yeah, well, she ended up going to Harvard. I think the exact story of how that went down is I've heard many different versions of.
Well, from people I have who heard were there, the version, her version, directly from her lips when I was a student at Harvard, and she said they wouldn't give me tenure back. And she didn't go to Harvard with tenure. She went to Harvard as a two-year visiting professor, and got tenure after 2 years.
Did she have tenure at Chicago before she left?
I believe she got tenure and had tenure for about a year, is my memory. But you can look into the Chicago archives on that. This is how she represents the story.
Well, fair enough. I'm not going to have a personal fight with her. Obviously, Justice Kagan was an incredibly prominent scholar. Three thoughts, though. So one is, I think, you know, most of her work, she had the one article on presidential administration based on her experience in the Clinton administration, which is now her, you know, most famous work. Most of her earlier work was, she had a couple First Amendment articles, you know, so she was covering a sort of different
area. And she wrote that article about how, like, confirmation hearings should be more rigorous and nominees should have to, like, say more about their views.
Yeah.
That didn't hold up as well when she was nominated.
I taught that article, actually. It holds up pretty well.
Yeah, I mean, I think she backed away from it a little bit.
Yeah, well, she could get away with it. I do think that the presidential administration article, like a lot of, you know, Justice Scalia scholarships, frankly, has taken on outsized importance and outsized valence now that she is a justice. I mean, and it already, you know, did in part because it could be seen, not totally accurately, but it could be seen as a kind of liberal endorsement of some of the unitary executive ideas. The article actually is careful not to endorse that, and obviously as a justice she has not endorsed those views, but it sort of like became part of that movement as well. So it really sort of took on a life of its own in a way that I think it's fair to say Justice Barrett's scholarship didn't do quite the same thing.
Well, it has not yet. Right now that she's on the court, it's almost certainly going to get cited more. But what you're saying is right. I looked at the citations, and her citations definitely in that article did go up post Justice Kagan's post joining the court. But, you know, I've got to think that's going to happen in the same way that, like, Justice Scalia co-wrote that book about statutory interpretation and, like, making arguments that has all these canons in it, and now everybody feels like they have to cite it as if it's some kind of authoritative thing.
Yeah. But I will say this about Justice Barrett is she's the only justice who I have ever invited to a symposium and, you know, had accept. So that kind of makes her the best no matter what.
Okay. That's fair. What was that? Was this pre-Supreme Court tenure or post?
It was pre-Seventh Circuit tenure. I think she was there was some question of whether she was going to be confirmed to the Seventh Circuit, I think, before or after the article hit print, which mattered for some reason, you know, maybe what the byline should say or something. It was a symposium on Justice Scalia in the University of Chicago Law Review after he passed away.
Well, maybe that symposium had, you know, kind of got her over the finish line in terms of confirmation. And so she should thank you. Okay. Are you issuing a mea culpa, or are you just, you're kind of fudging it on your claim?
Neither one. I'm going to stick to my guns.
Okay. Your guns being that she is the greatest law professor appointed since now Justice Story, nearly two centuries ago.
She's also publicly endorsed the Bode and Sachs thesis that originalism is our law.
Okay, well, that's a good reason.
If that doesn't make you the greatest.
What about Justice Holmes? Didn't Holmes teach at Harvard briefly?
If he did, he wasn't a professor.
Remembering that correctly?
Maybe.
He was mostly a lawyer.
And he was a state Supreme Court justice forever, right?
Yeah. Well, the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court. Now, I mean, Holmes, love him or hate him, right? He's a very controversial figure, but hugely important as a thinker about law, right? Like, set an intellectual
tone. Hugely important as a writer about law.
I don't think his views about, you know, kind of law, seeing law, going back to something we talked about at the beginning, seeing law as a command of the sovereign and not the brooding omnipresence in the sky that form the kind of intellectual underpinnings of Erie. You don't think that is important?
I see Holmes as a kind of proto-realist, right? Like before full-blown legal realism, he was one of the people starting to debunk these kind of pre-realist ideas about law, and those ideas are really important. And Holmes had just an amazing ability to summarize these things in a phrase and to write opinions that we still like to read 100 years later. But I'm not sure. Now we're going to get email from all the Holmes stands, I guess. But I'm not sure that he supplied a lot of the brilliant ideas so much as being one of the people who took some ideas that were kind of on the rise and just put them in a way that was hard to resist.
Okay, interesting. I don't know how Justice Farrar is under that test, because I'm not sure she has introduced kind of huge new ideas that have been game changing, but maybe. Okay, so you're not gonna back away from that. Can we just talk about one other piece of Supreme Court trivia about the justices for 1 second? Which I didn't know. Maybe you knew. Remember Justice Brandeis, who we've talked about, because we didn't remember is from Kentucky, even though Brandeis University is in Massachusetts. And he co-wrote this before he was a judge, co-wrote this famous article with Samuel Warren, who is his law partner, about mm-hmm. the right to privacy, this emerging common law right to privacy. That was very influential, highly cited. And I was actually looking at that article. We're using it in the Fourth Amendment article and sort of saying that there's some intellectual connection between this and what the court has done. But I didn't know. So Brandeis had structured a trust for Warren that his brothers sort of said screwed them out of money. And then Samuel committed suicide as kind of the denouement to that. Well, and this came up in the Senate confirmation hearings. And there's some, questions about how Brandeis behaved ethically. Now I've only read very brief descriptions of this and haven't dug into what exactly happened, but it's kind of a surprising end. I was just curious, who was his co-author in this article, and I didn't realize that this had happened.
You know hell of a way to end a co-authorship.
Yeah. You never heard that one?
No, I never heard that one. And now I'm never going to let you structure any trusts for me.
Well, that's good, because I'm not licensed in your or my jurisdiction. But I do have some estate planning advice for you if you need it. My guess is given that you couldn't even get yourself admitted to the Supreme Court bar without a lot of prodding, did you ever do it?
Not yet.
Okay, not yet. My guess is you haven't created a irrevocable family trust. Am I right?
I have a will.
That's not going to get the job done. We'll talk about that later. Okay, that was my piece of my piece of Supreme Court trivia for today.
Thanks for listening. Thanks to the Constitutional Law Institute for sponsoring our endeavors. Please remember, if you haven't yet rated or reviewed the podcast on the Apple Store or wherever you find the podcast, please remember to do that so we can keep listeners helping to find the show.
And if there's a long gap between this and our next episode, it will be because I am busy explaining and writing why Will is wrong about something else.